This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/artofman. That's lynda.com/artofman. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So in the past 10 years, there's been this increasing emphasis on happiness. There's tons of books written about it. Blogs are dedicated to how to be happier. And you're even seeing corporations becoming interested in tracking the happiness and well-being of their employees and instituting programs to increase their happiness. Governments are also getting in on the act. They're developing algorithms to track the happiness of their citizens. And on the surface, this sounds great, right? Like, that's awesome that companies and governments want us to be happy. But my guest today on the podcast makes the nuanced case that maybe this should give us some pause. His name is William Davies. He's the author of the book, The Happiness Industry, How the Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. And in the book, he gives us a history of tracking happiness, which began all the way back in the 1780s and has advanced throughout the centuries to what we have today, where you have devices that you can put on your brain that can actually track your mood moment to moment, and even devices that can change your mood moment to moment. While there's some benefits to that, it should give us some pause because what's happening is that it's beginning to have the market encroach into areas of our life that we never thought would be part of the market. I'm talking about family, friends, religion, spirituality. It's all geared towards tying happiness to dollar signs. At least that's the case he makes. So today on the podcast, we're going to discuss this. I thought it was really interesting as someone who's really got his ear to the ground in all this psychological research about happiness and well-being. Great counterpoint, a different perspective. So without further ado, William Davies, The Happiness Industry. Will Davies, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, so your book is called The Happiness Industry, How Big Business and Government Sold Us Well-Being. And the reason why I want to have you on the show to talk about this book, because it takes on a topic that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and it's this idea everywhere you go, blog posts, magazine articles, news shows about, it's all about how to be happy, how to increase your well-being. And it's kind of, I'm sort of drawn to it at one hand, but at the other time, I'm sort of repulsed by it, that I'm told that you need to be happy. I don't know. I guess the rebel in me doesn't like that. In your book, you sort of take on and critique what you call the happiness industry. Before we get into why being happy might not be such a great thing, having businesses being so interested in us being happy is not such a great thing. Can you explain what you mean by the happiness industry?
Sure. And I have similar feelings about this as you do, in that I think a society or a workplace that cares about our feelings is clearly a good thing. You don't want to live in a society that is indifferent to people's feelings. You don't want to be surrounded by managers or businesses that don't care about their impact on people's minds and their feelings and so on. But I was drawn to this topic in a similar way, in that it struck me that some, on the face of it, what were quite noble ethical impulses and agendas seem to be co-opted in certain ways by marketing, by management, by certain areas of government policy. And I think what's key here is the role of measurement and the role of economics. And particularly in the last 20 years, I would say, the happiness and emotions have become a very hot topic in economics, in neuroscience, particularly at the moment, to a growing extent in areas of computer science and what's called affective computing, which develops various techniques for trying to read the emotions of people via the movements of their faces or their eyes or the behavior of their brains and whatever it might be. And what's happened as a result of these advances in particular areas of social science and behavioral science and medical science is that certain interests in society, particularly those of corporations, but also those who are trying to come up with more efficient ways of delivering public services or health services or whatever it might be, or ways of trying to discipline certain areas of the population have used this body of knowledge and seen it as an opportunity to either make money or to cut costs or to try and change the way people behave. So I think it's particularly that co-option or that, excuse the sociological language, but that instrumentalization of ethical and political and cultural ideals in pursuit of rather more cynical agendas that I would term the happiness industry.
Okay, so this includes things like wearable tech, Fitbits. And I guess there's even now there's technology. I have a few pieces of this technology where you can put a band around your head and it can read brain waves and tell you if you are focused or if you are calm. What are some other
technologies that can actually try to influence your feelings that way as well?
Yeah, I just saw that just came out. I've been seeing ads for this thing. It's a device you stick to the side of your head and it can make you feel energized or calm.
Right.
I guess they use electricity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand the technology. There's one called Numitra, I think, which does something like that.
Yeah, and I guess you're seeing more corporations include things like mindfulness training, like they're encouraging their employees to meditate. There's nap rooms now. A lot of businesses have nap rooms. So, you know, on the face, it seems like, well, that's great, you know, that the businesses are doing this. But you make the case in your book that in a strange way, they've actually created this problem. Like they're doing this to make us more productive. It's not just to be nice. Like they want to get more out of us.
Yes. I think businesses have been interested in feelings and happiness for a long time. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is to not just tell the more recent story, which I outlined very briefly just now, but to also put this in the longer context. Businesses have been interested in psychology and emotions since at least the 1920s. And in the workplace, with the rise of the what we now call human resources, there has been concern to try and talk to employees in the right way and so on, and to make sure they feel good about themselves. It's got quite a long history because it's known that this has an impact on their productivity. I think one of the things that the happiness science of the last 20 or 25 years has changed is that people can now put dollar signs on that extra productivity or on those emotions. So some of the happiness economists have calculated that a happy employee is 12% more productive than an unhappy employee. I mean, these kind of calculations vary. The opinion polling company Gallup does all of this research on what they call employee engagement, which suggests that less than a third of the workforce in countries like the United States are fully psychologically engaged in their work, and that this is costing hundreds of billions of dollars a year to the US economy. And I don't question the evidence as such. What I think one of the dangers with this type of evidence is that it does create rather a cynical approach, which looks to, in a sense, change the symptom rather than look at the cause. So if it is true that employees are stressed or unhappy or disengaged, one of the problems with trying to put dollar signs on those problems is that immediately people get drawn to just trying to deal with the symptom. They just try to say, well, how can we kind of just sort of, you know, re-energize people? You know, what do we need to do? Do we need to give them free lunch? Do we need to give them free gym membership? Do we need to kind of track their behavior using a wearable? Or do we just kind of, I mean, one of the stories I heard when I was talking about the book in Philadelphia a couple of months ago was someone in the audience told me that he worked in a casino there where employees were required to dance to Pharrell Williams's Happy with the manager once a week in an effort to try, you know, start the week with a kind of, you know, pep everybody up and get them going. Now, this kind of thing clearly is going to yield its own negative forms of cynicism, of further psychological disengagement. Human beings are not lab rats. They can't just have their psychology or their behavior tweaked purely by some kind of, you know, slight tweaking of the environment. I think that the question of how to produce fulfilling work is a serious one, but that also requires businesses and managers to engage in some rather more complicated questions about the extent to which people are able to kind of fit work around the rest of their lives, or the extent to which people can have genuine time off, or the extent to which people have a say in how they go about their work. The sorts of areas where a lot of this happiness science is being put to work are in areas like call centers, which are quite stressful, high surveillance environments where labor turnover is incredibly high because it's not enjoyable work. And the managers turn to the happiness science to try and find out how they can deal with these problems, simply to try and sort of change the symptom, change the way in which people's emotions are churning around in the workplace, rather than to actually question the nature of the work itself.
Yeah, that was an interesting point, because I'm a big fan of the resilient, you know, being resilient, like resilience training, learning how to remain calm even when things are going crazy around you. But at the same time, I always had that question for folks whenever I've talked to people who are experts in resilience or whatever, and say, well, how do you make things better, right? This just like puts a Band-Aid on the problem, right? How do I solve the problem where I don't have to be resilient anymore for that particular thing? And I feel like the whole idea of just being mindful and being resilient, it sort of puts the question of how to solve these problems to the side and just deal with it. We can't solve it. It's too big. Just be resilient. You'll be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think these types of responses, particularly amongst public policymakers, these types of responses arise partly as a result of the powerlessness of policymakers more generally, and that it's harder to tackle stress, tackle insecurity, the sources of anxiety and depression, which it's clear from certain areas of social science, areas such as social epidemiology and these kinds of research areas, that things like depression and anxiety are triggered by things in the environment to a large extent. Of course, they also have neurological and biological dimensions to them, but they don't just arise out of nowhere. And it's no coincidence that they are much higher in the rates are much higher in societies such as the United States or in Britain than they are in, for instance, in lots of Northern European nations. And I think that in a way, the resort to saying, well, in that case, we need to somehow teach individuals to be more resilient or more mindful or to look after their mental health better is partly a symptom of the political powerlessness, in a way, to actually challenge some of the forces for insecurity, inequality, high levels of materialism and competitiveness, which are known to correlate closely to levels of things like depression. And I mean, you see this in the school system. I mean, in Britain, where I live, there's a great movement to try and teach more techniques such as happiness and resilience and so on in school, and to introduce mindfulness into classrooms and so on. But if you look elsewhere in the education system, the teachers suffer terrible levels of stress because they're all constantly being monitored and audited by the government. Pupils are all suffering terrible levels of anxiety and stress because they're constantly tested the whole time. They never have any time off from between testing. You know, as soon as they come back from the summer holidays, there's a test within a couple of weeks. So you have all of these kind of stress factors, but no one questions the stress factors. All they do is say, well, in that case, we need to have more resilience training to make sure that individuals can cope with this kind of thing. But I think that at a certain point, you can't just allow mental health problems to get worse and worse, particularly amongst children and young people, without beginning to also question some of the cultural and institutional factors that trigger that.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, guys, do you want to learn a new skill this year? Maybe you want to get a promotion or a raise, or maybe you want to start your own business and you need to learn how to start a website or acquire some skill that'll allow you to do that. Or maybe you want to just learn something new for a hobby. Well, if that's you, you need to check out lynda.com. Lynda.com is an online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses taught by experts from a wide variety of fields. They have courses on productivity. That class is taught by David Allen. He's the guy that wrote Getting Things Done. Courses on photography, videography. Right now I'm doing the course on Photoshop, which is coming really handy with my business. And what's great about Lynda is you can do the course from from your desktop, your smartphone, your tablet. You can do it at your own pace. There's no set schedule. And also there's transcripts. So if you don't like just sitting and watching someone, maybe you're like a reader, you can read the course if you want as well. Anyways, if you want to try lynda.com, I got a deal for you. Go to lynda.com/artofman and sign up for a free 10-day trial. Again, that's lynda.com/artofman for a free 10-day trial, and you'll have access to all of the 3,000 courses at lynda.com. Go check it out. Also by Mack Weldon. All right, if you're like most men, you've probably been using the same brand of underwear since you were a teenager. But here's the thing. In the past few years, there's been several companies innovating the world of underwear. Yes, it's possible to innovate underwear. And one of these companies that's doing a great job at it is Mack Weldon. So one of the things they've done to improve underwear is the fabric they use. On all their underwear, they use Pima cotton, which is naturally antimicrobial. So it eliminates the odor. And they have one pair of underwear you should check out. They use a fabric that Special Forces and NASA uses that completely eliminates the odor. And you can, in fact, wear this underwear 5 days in a row without washing it, and it will not smell. They've also improved the design of underwear, particularly their boxer briefs, so they don't ride up your legs, so you don't have to stick your hands down your pants to adjust. Really fit great and are very comfortable. Besides the underwear, they have undershirts made from the Pima cotton, so natural antimicrobial, and it doesn't stink. They also have some great looking socks, and Mack Weldon makes your life easy by selling these packages. So you'll get like a couple days worth of underwear, undershirts, and socks all in one little neat package. So if you want to improve your underwear game, go to mackweldon.com. That's mackweldon.com and enter promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off your first purchase. Again, that's mackweldon.com, promo code AOM for 20% off. So you mentioned just a little bit ago that this desire of businesses, governments to be concerned about the mental well-being of their employees or their citizens isn't new, and it goes way back. And you make the case that the seeds of all this techno-mindful utopia that we have today were sown by the founder of utilitarianism, Jeremy Bentham. For our listeners who aren't familiar with utilitarianism, can you explain what that is, and how is it that utilitarianism led to, you know, Fitbits and mood trackers and things like that?
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot in between, but
yeah.
Jeremy Bentham was an English philosopher, but he was actually a lawyer originally, who was born in the late 18th century. He worked between the late 18th century and he died, I think, in the 1830s. And he was a product of the Enlightenment, and he looked at things like the law and looked at politics and looked at the activities of the government, also looked at the French revolutionaries and the American revolutionaries, and he thought all of it, across whether it was conservatives or radicals, that they were all distracted and deluded by abstract philosophical ideas like justice or theological ideas like the divine right of kings, or revolutionaries talking about like innate human rights and this sort of thing, people like Thomas Paine. And he thought that it was all basically nonsense. And he thought the only way to put politics and law on scientific foundations was to learn from what was going on in the natural sciences at the same time, in chemistry and physics and elsewhere, which he thought looked rational and coherent in a way that what was going on in the political realm and philosophy and law was kind of fueled by this nonsensical use of language. And he argued that we need to turn to what is the underlying physical underpinnings of our ethical intuitions, of our ethical principles. And he said that the only thing that you can really found ethics on, or politics on, or any notion of justice on, is the fact that all human beings have an innate natural tendency to pursue pleasure and avoid pain. And he meant this in quite a physical sense. He didn't mean it in just a sort of abstract or philosophical sense. He meant it in the sense that we are animals that are driven to maximize our own pleasure and to avoid pain. And on top of this natural theory about humans, he constructed a theory of utilitarianism, which suggested that the only way in which governments could run society in any scientific sense would be to construct things in a way that as much pleasure was distributed as possible, which amounted to what we call happiness, and as little pain was generated as possible. But governments could also do things like deliberately intervene with forms of pain that is punishment, to change the way people behave. So that you would, you know, you think of something like a speed camera or something. You want people to slow down in their car. So you create certain sort of carefully calculated interventions to try and change the way people behave by the threat of some kind of punishment. So he thought that you could have a science of politics, and he thought that that it was this natural sense that we are basically driven by our pleasures and our pains, that he thought could be the foundations of that politics. Now, what I've argued in the book is that this belief that it's our bodies that really are at the heart of ethics and are at the heart of politics, and that likewise the political language and the philosophical language and moral language is a dangerous distraction. These are kind of key ideas in Jeremy Bentham's work, and I argue in the book, in a way, you can see this same bias, I suppose, at work in a lot of Silicon Valley innovations today. So, you know, so we look at something like the Apple Watch or something like that, and the promise of these technologies is that instead of us having to rely on what we say we're doing or what we think we're doing or what we tell other people we're doing or tell other people we like or whatever, that what these things will do is to provide hard data about what our bodies say is going on in our lives. So, you know, they will tell us how you're sleeping, how much you're walking, how much water you're drinking. They say that the next generation of Apple Watches or in a couple of generations' time, it will tell you things about your emotions and how you're feeling. You can do forms of data mining on people's text messages or their Twitter use to analyze what they're feeling in terms of what's called sentiment analysis. So there's a similar prejudice as Jeremy Bentham had, you know, over 200 years ago, which says stop listening to what people tell you. Stop dwelling in what Bentham called the tyranny of sounds, people talking about, oh, you know, I like this, I like that, this is what I believe, these are my principles and so on, and get towards this science of the body, science of choices, of behavior, of physical responses and the physical symptoms of emotions rather than the linguistic world of how people talk about things.
Why is listening to the body not a good way to go to figure out what people really want, right? Like, you know, neurotransmitters are released, neurons fire, hormones are released to a particular response. I mean, what would be the counter to that? I mean, why listen to someone? They say, yeah, I'm happy, but then their body chemistry says, well, no.
Sure. I mean, I suppose I think these things, this is partly about balance. I don't think you, none of this stuff is going to go away anytime soon. And I'm not suggesting that we should just sort of, you know, abandon this science altogether. But I think the problem is that a lot of the time the first problem with it is that it starts to bestow great powers upon the scientists in this situation. And they're not necessarily scientists who work in universities with a kind of vocation to the broader public good or to knowledge or something. They might be scientists working in private companies who are effectively, you know, working to pursue profit, which is, you know, that's the nature of these things, is that the companies that are collecting this data and analyzing this data are doing so on their own terms a lot of the time, which doesn't mean that they don't deliver benefits to their users and their customers, but there's a kind of a concentration of power in amongst all of this. I think the one of the problems with this is with the way happiness science is going at the moment is that as companies, as technology developers, as scientists get more and more confident that they can actually see the symptoms of emotions, or they can actually witness the emotion itself almost, whether that be via a neuroscan or whether it be via various facial scanning technologies and so on, is what does that what happens to our own accounts of what's going on? I mean, do they still matter? I mean, if, for instance, it's possible to monitor how an entire audience is reacting to a concert or something, which it now is. I mean, this is now done. I mean, one of the examples in the book I give is at a literary festival in Britain a couple of years ago, this smile harvesting technology was set up around the site to try and kind of collect data on how people were feeling from one moment to the next and so on. So this kind of thing is already going on. Now, does that mean that we don't need critics any longer, or does that mean that we don't kind of discuss things in newspapers or in other ways to try and analyze what we think is, think about it, and what happens to human language and human discourse in amongst all of this. Now, I'm not saying that we're necessarily silenced, but I think that sometimes what people say they think about something, or the reasons they give for their feelings, need to be taken very seriously, particularly where there's some kind of injustice involved. So sometimes people are not simply just unhappy or suffering a lack of pleasure in the way that Bentham might have recognized, but they actually have a serious grievance that they don't that they want to articulate. They want to be heard, and they want they want to hang on to that grievance until it's alleviated in some way. If someone feels that there's an injustice in their society, to try and reframe that in terms of some kind of neural event or some kind of displeasure is a gross misunderstanding of how that person understands themselves and understands their lives. And I think that it's that kind of depoliticizing effect of the sort of Silicon Valley view of the world, or the Benthamite view of the world, that troubles me, because we need to grant people the power and the authority to carry on saying, no, this is what I think, this is how I feel, this is what I think needs to change in order for me to change my response to it, rather than to allow all of those things to become in the hands of certain experts or those who have the best technology to monitor our feelings.
Yeah, you made an interesting point in the book, how you're seeing more and more, it seems like with this whole emphasis on big data, it is in a lot of ways replacing morality. Like, or it's moral philosophy, right? Because yeah. We can't agree on anything in our multicultural world, well, we'll just rely on this data to figure out what's good, what's bad.
Yeah. And this is something which, in a way, that's also what Jeremy Bentham was effectively kind of hoping for. I mean, obviously, in the late 18th century, that was a hell of a long way off at the time. But over the course of the 20th century, the tools and the methodologies developed in psychology and in the behavioral sciences to realize or at least kind of start to push towards that kind of ideal. But one of the interesting things is that there's been previous waves of this kind of exuberance. There was a wave of what the first era of behaviorism, and behaviorism refers to the idea that it's possible to effectively to manage people or govern people or to predict their behavior purely by observing them. That if you can get enough data on someone, then you don't need to actually kind of go and ask them any questions or try and understand them on their own terms. You can simply kind of collect enough data, and then they become as predictable as anything in the natural world. So, and there was the first wave of behaviorism, and I talk about this a bit in the book, was really between around about the time of the First World War and the 1930s, where you had a whole various psychologists. You had the world's first management consultant, Frederick Taylor, and huge excitement in the advertising industry that it was going to be possible to really get to the bottom of why people buy what they buy, and that you wouldn't actually have to even give people, you know, make the products any good. You could just sort of kind of manipulate people purely by getting the science right. Now, of course, this is nonsense, and it kind of started to fall apart over the course of the 1930s, and actually what replaced it, or what started to usurp it, was rather more sensitive, more socially conscious things like, well, there were things like the rise of opinion polling, and not long after that, things like focus groups, things which actually tried to sort of understand, get inside people's worlds a little bit more. But then you had another wave of it in the 60s with people like B.F. Skinner and famously Robert McNamara thought that the Vietnam War could be won purely through the application of statistics and behavioral principles. And then we're getting another wave now with big data. And all of this, in a way, it's this sort of recurring utopia, recurring idealism, starts with Bentham, keeps recurring, that the way to live, we can get around thorny dilemmas about how we should live our lives, or how we should run our businesses, or how we should sell our products, whatever it might be, purely by consulting the data. And I mean, if you read some of the big data, the more hysterical big data stuff at the moment, I mean, this is what people are saying, is they're saying, you know, the managers of the future won't have to know the first thing about running a business. All they'll have to understand is how to feed questions into kind of, you know, data analytics, and all you need is going to have data scientists, and that all the answers will just come out of that. Well, I mean, the first problem with that is employees aren't going to be very happy working in companies where those running the companies effectively view them in this kind of like lab rats. People, it matters to people whether or not their voices are heard or not. It matters to people whether their autonomy or their humanity really is respected. And situations where people are kind of reduced to data points don't tend to be very happy ones in the long run. So there's a kind of I think something kind of self-defeating about some of this stuff.
Yeah. And another thing that troubles me about this whole happiness industry, and you talk about this in the book as well, is that there seems to be an encroachment of the market on aspects of our lives that you wouldn't think would have a dollar sign next to it. Mm-hmm. So relationships, your friendships, your marriage, even spirituality, these researchers are trying to find ways that to optimize that, but not optimize it just for you know, because you want to have better friendship, but because better friendship can make you happier, which will in turn make you a more productive employee.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's important to try and disentangle the good intentions from some of the negative applications here, and I think that's always the problem in this area.
Sure.
Is that there's always this kind of entanglement of good intentions and some rather more cynical uses. In terms of the intentions, well, in a way, a lot of the happiness science begins by trying to properly value non-market good. So actually, one of the things that happiness scientists have been saying since the 1960s is actually, you know, we've got to stop putting dollar signs on everything. We've got to recognize that actually what matters to people is things like spending time with their family, having some nice public spaces, having green spaces, having having time to do things other than just try and make more and more money. This is actually what a lot of the research in the happiness science suggests. I think the ultimately a lot of what positive psychology says to people is also in line with that. It says, you know, stop just comparing yourself to everyone else. Stop trying to focus on yourself. Try to notice other people and notice the world around you and think about other people. And, you know, who can be against all of that? I think that the problem is that once you start to measure things and you start to quantify happiness, then of course then it can also be put to other uses. And there will always be those who look to some of that research to try and think about, well, in that case, we need to, build in an analysis of things like social relationships and non-market goods into our sales strategy or into our employee relations strategy or this sort of thing. And I think that, you know, the where you take a more self-centered or a slightly more cutthroat approach to some of that research, for instance, you know, there's all this research showing that if your friends are unhappy, you're more likely to be unhappy. It's called emotional contagion. It was partly what Facebook were trying to test when they did their emotional contagion study which was published last year, where they were manipulating people's news feeds to see if they could spread kind of emotions across different social networks. But ultimately, if you were, you know, purely focused on yourself and on your career or your entrepreneurial ventures, well, you might read lots of this literature and think, well, I've got to basically start cutting certain people out of my life because they're spreading bad vibes, and I've got to do that in order to be happier because there's research showing that being happier is going to make me work harder and sleep better and make more money. And so I think there are not all of it, but there are areas of this agenda which are lend themselves to quite an egotistical, highly competitive ethos, where effectively it's almost a hoarding of happiness, as it can often be, and a hoarding of money, whereas that is often entangled with these rather more kind of altruistic and generous approaches, many of which are manifest in things like positive psychology. But there's some good and some bad.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you see that a lot. amongst like personal development blogs. There's tons of them, tons of books about that. And they offer these great bits of advice, like hang out with your friends, you need to get outside more, you need to exercise, you need to meditate, drink water. And it's always, and it always ends like, so you can like make more money.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's a part of me that I guess I'm a romantic. Mm-hmm. And I like to have something like a greater good, and I don't want it just to be about money, but it seems like that's what it's all about now.
Yeah. I also think data, you know, I mean, there's something very pernicious about data at the moment. Everything's quantified and everything is data. And it's, I mean, I don't doubt that it's true, for instance, that spending time with near foliage is good for you. I mean, this is what happiness scientists have shown. People do studies. There are studies showing that the color green has a positive effect on our brains. And, you know, this is why it's good to be near trees and we should be outside and all this sort of stuff. But I think it removes part of the pleasure of going for a walk in a forest if you've got all of that in the back of your mind. It certainly removes the pleasure if you're going for that walk in the forest in order to somehow kind of make some investment in your brain or your body. And you know, imagine if you were going for a nice walk with someone else in that situation, and you discovered that they were only there because they'd read that it was going to somehow make them more productive the next day or something like that. I think you'd feel pretty disappointed.
Yeah, and I also think the emphasis on happiness forces us to miss out on like the whole human experience. Like there are benefits to sometimes feeling angry. There are benefits of sometimes feeling in a low mood and depressed. But happiness, like, well, no, don't do that. That is bad. You should not feel that way.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think, but this is partly, I mean, go back to Jeremy Bentham. I mean, the requirement of happiness science is always that things can be placed on a scale. That things have to go between, I mean, the nature of the scale varies. Sometimes it's 0 to 10, sometimes it's -5 to +5. But it has to, you have to put numbers on things rather than attach different words to them. So, I mean, you've just mentioned two different words, angry and depressed. Well, for a happiness scientist, depressed would have to be a -5 and angry would have to be like a -2 or something. You wouldn't be able to see them as two separate types of things. But I mean, I often think that one of the most problematic terms that we have, I think, from the perspective of happiness science is when you say I was moved by something. Imagine, you know, when you're moved by whatever it might be, a family experience or going to the theater or something. What, you know, where the hell is that in the, when we say that, what are we referring to? Because often we cry, often we feel sad, often we, but you still feel happy and sad at the same time. And it doesn't really fit with anything. It doesn't sort of fit on any scale. And yet, in a way, that's what makes us feel most alive. And I think that in a way that, you have to respect the capacities of human beings to use language in ways that make sense, but aren't necessarily reducible to scientific metrics.
As I was reading your book, the thing that kept coming back into my mind was Brave New World.
Mm.
Right, that was I feel like what's going on in a very soft sort of way. In fact, I just got done talking to a psychologist who specializes in humor research. And he was discussing how Big Pharma is now tickling mice to figure out the benefits of laughing on mammalian brains in order to develop a pill that can, you take it, you will feel happy. I mean, it's like soma, like real life soma. And that to me is somewhat troubling. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one key part of this, which we haven't touched on, is antidepressants, which of course... I argue in the book that, in a way, antidepressants transform the whole notion of happiness and the whole notion of unhappiness in ways that I think reach far further than just the psychiatry or the pharmaceutical industry or those who happen to take pills. Because in a way, when antidepressants were discovered in the late 1950s, they weren't kind of properly commercialized until the 1980s. But when they were discovered, it completely changed how initially scientists, but later more culturally, more generally, people would conceive of things like mood, because the idea that mood is something that is rooted in your physical being wouldn't have really made a lot of sense until antidepressants were discovered at that time. I mean, there were psychiatrists who argued this, but they were pretty marginal. And I think the idea that it's possible to change our feelings by changing our bodies, or in particular our brains, is partly a symptom of a culture in which antidepressants have become so pervasive, or at least so culturally significant. That's not to say that mood doesn't have physical dimensions to it. Clearly it does. I mean, I'm not denying whole bodies of research, but I think again, it's important to distinguish between something which is a symptom from something which is a broader cause or the broader meaning of a term. So depression has certain symptoms, such as kind of inability to sleep, or inability to or sleeping too much, or whatever it might be. And often what happens with the medical approach to these things is that they start to focus too much on particular physical symptoms, and the whole question of how someone came to feel in a certain way starts to drop out of the equation. And in terms of your example of tickling mice, one of the most troubling areas in all of this, which comes out of neuroscience again and areas of neuroeconomics and this sort of thing, is you get research which shows that the very act of smiling has triggered certain neurological activities which make you feel better. So that some of the gurus of neuroscience, I'm not necessarily talking about the people who are doing the research in universities and elsewhere, but some of the people who turn it into the positive thinking mantras and the business books and so on will say, well, in that case, you've got to just exercise your mouth. You've got to turn the corners of your mouth up certain times a day. It's like a sort of exercise, doing yoga or going to the gym or something, because this way you're going to keep the right chemicals flowing around your brain. Now, again, I mean, I don't question the science. I'm not qualified to do so, but I think we have to question what that means culturally. If people are being encouraged to do what effectively is a insincere act, purely with a view to try and look after their serotonin levels or whatever it might be, or their career.
So, happiness fascism.
Well, it's not a term that I use, but various people have pointed out the echoes of Brave New World, and I think that I think the problem is it's not that this stuff doesn't work. I think just like in Brave New World, it's possibly the problem is that it works too well, and what do we lose in the process?
So this all leads to the question, like, what do we do with this, right? So we have this research, we have this technology. I mean, it seems like you've been hinting that there possibly is a role for it in our life, but how do we figure out that balance?
Mm. It's very difficult, and I think that a lot of the trends are pulling us further in this direction, particularly with technology at the moment. I think the sorts of things that I think would be provide an alternative in the future, although I'm not holding my breath that this is going to happen anytime soon, is to start to try and bring back in a kind of institutional logic. So to return to my example of schools from earlier, look at some of the evidence on depression and anxiety and stress amongst young people, and think about how you would design and run schools differently in ways that allowed people to flourish. Because after all, I'm not in the book. I'm not against happiness. I'm not against flourishing. I think in a way we need to get back to some of the early, more idealistic era of the happiness science or happiness agenda in a way. But ultimately, what people need to be happy in a more authentic sense, or in a less kind of manipulated sense, is to stop looking into themselves, stop seeing all the sources of their feelings as somehow internal to themselves. So I think that actually we need to stop blaming our own brains, our own selves, or whatever it might be, for the way we feel. And in a way, we need kind of less science, if that's possible. I mean, I don't think it's difficult to imagine, but less science of the brain or of the self or of behavior or of the feelings, and more experiments, I suppose, in different ways of living, different ways of running institutions, which might allow people to spend less time worrying about themselves, less time comparing themselves to other people, which, after all, is what a lot of positive psychology also suggests. I think ultimately there are deep-lying philosophical contradictions in the happiness agenda. I think that once you reach the point where a scientist or a manager or a market researcher claims to know how someone else is feeling without that person even being consulted in any way, purely purely quantitative scientific sense, I think that they're beginning to miss something about that person. I think this sort of a certain type of rebellion against that kind of big data, high surveillance behaviorism will happen at some point. Exactly how it manifests itself, I think, remains to be seen.
Interesting. Well, Will Davies, where can people learn more about your work?
Well, I have a blog at potlatch.org.uk. I am on Twitter at Davis_Will. And you can read my book, The Happiness Industry.
All right, Will Davies, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you very much.
My guest today was William Davies. He's the author of the book, The Happiness Industry, How the Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. And you can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you use to listen to the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.